Welcome back to Escape from Plan A. Very excited because this week, a wild Jess appears. Jess, what's going on? Welcome back.
Life just came at me hard. I don't know what to say. I know I kind of like vanished there for a good long minute. But you know, still here. I guess
from the pod, you didn't vanish. Like we kept in touch.
Oh yeah. But I know I just bounced on Discord and everything. Obviously, I haven't been on the pod in a very long while. Life's just got real for a good long minute.
Well, I mean, life is real, you know. Mm-hmm. I don't know what to say about it other than, you know, it's good to have you back.
glad to be back. I mean, it's not like I feel like we've all just kind of like, I was thinking about this the other day. Like we've been at this for 8 years. That's a long time.
Yeah.
Like we got started right after basically like the year Trump took office, right?
Yeah.
And you know, so it's 2017. So
is that 17, 18, 19, 20? That's 4, 1, 2, 3. Yeah. You're right about 8 years.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I mean, that's a big chunk of time, both like socially and personally.
We were different people.
8 years changes you. Like, there's no way to hide that. So just wanted to take a minute to acknowledge that. Like, and anybody who's been here from the beginning, like. Stand up, please. I really want to know. but I feel like we're just completely different people. And I think, you know, if we actually took the time to review our content that we've been putting out, I think we would actually see like a marked shift.
I think so
during
too.
That time.
I think so too.
Like collectively and individually, like I look back at who I was 8 years ago and I don't recognize her.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
I think good. You know, there's disappointments, you know, I certainly haven't crushed like the career milestones I just sort of assumed I would. So in that sense, it's a disappointment, but the big difference is I no longer really care about those goals.
Yeah.
So it doesn't feel like a failure. In fact, if I looked back and then thought to myself that I actually had put in, you know, the sacrifice or been, you know, just swallowed my, you know, whatever shreds of humanity I'm clinging to and just go full psychopath to actually, you know, go, you know, pedal to the metal on that shit, I think I'd have ended up regretting that more. So on balance, like I like myself better, I think. And I think I was kind of nervous thinking about that, but then like that realization is like, yeah, okay, well that's hard one. I'm more or less happy with personally with how I've come along.
Yeah, I hung out with Chris Jung and Adam for the first time in a while. I mean, I saw them like when we did that short film event, like when we premiered Dan's short film. And that, like, I told Chris,
I'm not an activist. If you go check it out, go watch it again on YouTube. Go watch it again. Go support. It's still great.
Yeah, and I heard that they screened it at like a film festival again down in, I believe, at USC.
Oh no way!
And, yeah,
can't believe I missed that.
Uh-huh. Millie told me about that, and and also Dan's on. You know, Dan got. I heard he got some like grant or something from HBO Films, so he's got stuff going on. And that evening, that night when we did that, that was really fun. It was just a really, you know, we did it at this old fire station that's become sort of like a community, like arts community center. It's like this really cool fire station, just immediately south of Chinatown. And, you know, it was a packed room, and It was sort of like a, I told Chris, like, this was sort of like a capstone project for us as a mm-hmm. group. And it felt that way. And it was just like a fun summer thing for us to do. I wish I'd been able to come out at that time. I know it's difficult, but mm-hmm. we were thinking about you and it was really fun. And then after that, you know, I think we kind of all just sort of decided to, all right, we've got to get back to some of our own, you know, life needs living, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, they still occasionally jumped on the pod and do, you know, and we occasionally hung out, but I had not seen, like, the four of us had not just kind of hung out in, like, you know, since for like a year and a half or maybe almost a little bit more. Mm-hmm. So I saw them last night and then it dawned on me, I'm like, oh my God, these are like my old friends now.
Yeah.
Like, these are not new friends anymore. These are like old friends, and we're the type of friends that, you know, used to see each other a lot more, and now when we get together, we reminisce about the, you know, like,
yeah, yeah,
you know, and it was really nice. And then, yeah, we were hanging out at some bar, and then found out that was the bar that Tom Brady met Giselle in, and then Adam said he would never wash his pants again. I was like, oh my God, I had no idea we were on holy ground. You know, I would have dressed nicer if I knew it was that place.
But they're divorced now, so, you know, the magic's gone.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Yeah, no, it was cool. It was cool seeing them, and yeah, just, I don't know. It was nice. Mm-hmm. You know? Especially, like, when people are like, oh yeah, you know, you stop making new friends after college. You know,
that has not been the case for me.
Sad, in fact, if people think that,
I mean, to each their own. And I know people, you know, like in the day, if you have ride or dies, you are lucky, you are blessed, right? However they come your way. But like personally, like I don't keep in touch with many people from college, if at all. The best friends I've had are the ones that I grew up with, like the ones I went to like high school and elementary school with, mm-hmm. or the friends that I met after, like, you know, and that's real luck of the draw there. 'Cause after college, like, I feel like the tendency is for people's lives to get really small after college. Like, you it basically happen, meet your coworkers, you know, you date around for a number of years, and then ideally, quote ideally, you settle down, right? Which means like you have one partner, you start a family maybe. So it's like your nuclear family plus maybe coworkers and, you know, a handful of friends that, you know, you keep in touch with, but mostly you're talking about maybe someday getting together.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So it takes real effort. But you know, it's worth it to put in that work. I feel really lucky to have met all of you guys.
Yeah. You got to come back to New York at some point.
I will.
I have had LA on my, you know, to go list or whatever. And mm-hmm. for whatever freaking reason, I just never freaking go. It's so annoying. I'm so annoyed with myself for not just jumping on a plane and going out to LA. But mm-hmm. every time there's some scheduling issue or there's some, you know, whatever, and so we just don't go. Or I just, I don't know, like I, you know, because I had to switch offices recently. Mm-hmm. Essentially like a new job, but you know, my firm put me out on loan to the client, so I'm like at the client now. And that I had actually like a good amount of downtime between the because of the switch. And I was like, yeah, I'm going to go to California. And then I just didn't do it. You know, it was very annoying. Mm-hmm. And so I haven't been on the West Coast in like freaking forever.
I'm definitely going to come out. It's just been like pretty much same reasons. Also, you know, last year my dog was very sick, so it was really difficult to to find the time to like get away from everything. But like, I don't know. Part of me is okay. I don't know where I'm going with this, but, and I'm not discounting like travel or anything. as a thing, but like between East and West Coast, I feel like the distance is growing, like the cultural distance is growing smaller. It's kind of
you think so?
Weird. I do think so.
Okay. What do you mean by that? I mean, I probably agree with you, but are you just saying it's becoming more like blandly, you know, metropolitan, urban, whatever?
Yeah, like, there's that. Like you're talking, like you're rattling off a list of problems that New York has right now, and I'm like nodding along. So, you know, I feel like all these metropolitan areas are becoming like socially more similar to each other than not. Right. Like the high crime, like vague undercurrent of anxiety, vague or acute undercurrent of anxiety, skyrocketing cost of living and all the, you know, concurrent, you know, whatever that does to a person, you know, I feel like that's a common thread. Store closures. I mean, last week I went to this small business, like a small plant store, basically a real mom and pop small plant store that just really, like through the years, they really put their heart and soul into it, like sourcing really healthy, really rare plants at a really good price, making sure people are educated on how to take care of them, like being a real part of the community. Like they were like, they did stuff like urban composting. There's really cool stuff, really like trying to be part of the community. And then last week they closed. They couldn't make ends meet paying their people properly, you know, providing all the like white glove service to their clientele, you know, quality products at a good price. They just couldn't make ends meet. And, you know, their new tenants are like a boba shop.
Yeah.
Which is crazy. Like, I don't know about you guys over there. I assume the story is the same, but like we are being drowned in bubbles here.
Do you have that chain Gongcha, like the Gongcha?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's like everywhere now. Like every possible little nook and cranny, there's a Gongcha there, you know? Like
Yeah.
But look, here's the thing. Like I'm not going out to LA for the culture. I'm going I got to see people, you know?
Yeah.
I got to see you. Yeah. I got to see my, you know, my college buddy. I got to see, you know, Shan's got to go see her college roommate, you know. So many people.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, it's the people.
Yeah.
But like as far as like it's like, oh wow, there's something totally unique about the place. Like I feel like no, that's not really quite the case anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Like I'm definitely gonna come out. That's definitely to see like the Plan A people. I don't know why Plan A was so New York heavy. I think you did a lot of recruitment in your hood.
You know, it was weird. I don't know. There just ended up being a lot of people like in New York. I don't know. I think maybe I always wondered because I always thought that Southern California had its own sort of Asian American like culture subculture there that was like much more developed than like East Coast. And so a lot of like this like assimilation questions and identity stuff was more like a New York thing than it was an LA thing. Cause I feel like LA people were just LA people. And there's like a certain kind of like Asian American insouciance to like SoCal types that, you know, there's just like a sort of like, I don't know, like nothing bothers them. And they're just kind of like, why are you worried about shit? Like, I don't know, you know, like what is this all about? You know, I don't know if that rings true at all, but
it does. I feel like through Plan A,
people in LA just are much less, or Southern California generally are their own beast in terms of, you know, when we first started out talking about like these, you know, Asian American cultural issues of great importance, I felt like LA, SoCal just didn't care about that stuff.
I generally agree. Like, I think I had to learn to be Asian American when I left high school to go to college on the East Coast.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in talking to you guys, talking to people who were like kind of came up on the East Coast that kind of like opened my eyes to that kind of level of analysis of cultural/racial issues like that. I had never really considered that before.
That's funny because I viewed it as the inverse. I thought that, you know, when I went out to California, that there was a certain like clearer notion of Asian American. Like, that meant something in California, whereas on the East Coast, like, that was like this vague, this, that was a weird vague idea that was coming out from the West Coast, and we didn't really think in terms of Asian American as an identity as much as California did. I don't know if that's two people, if that's two coasts talking past each other.
I think that is, because it's like, it's, you know, like, if
there isn't, you ask, there just me, wasn't like much of an idea of Asian American identity, whereas we saw that coming out of California.
I think, but it's
you know,
I think it's it too, for me it felt like a fish being asked if it's wet, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it sort of had, so in this case, I'm the fish, someone's asking me if I'm wet, and I kind of have to put myself out, like, where's the edge of the fishbowl then, and kind of look outside in at myself and then say like, yeah, oh, okay. Yeah. I am wet. I think.
Yeah.
I think, I don't know, like in SoCal, maybe California as a whole, I feel like Asian American is, kind of the confidence of ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
Like not ignorance, but like obliviousness, but because mm-hmm. it's just so numerically dominant.
Mm-hmm.
There is nowhere to go in Southern California where you're not going to see a critical mass of Asian people. Like, I have never been the only Asian anywhere. You know, yeah, far from.
I mean, that's not really untrue, I would say, of New York either. I don't know if that's like more recent. I would say it's become even more Asian over time. And that was one of the mm-hmm. things that, like, I was getting actually very interested in when Dan came out to do the film here, was this idea of New York City as an Asian city. It's that usually not thought of that way. Like, it'll be, people will think of New York in terms of rich WASPs, it's a Latino city, it's a Jewish city, it's a Black city, you know, but rarely is New York portrayed as an Asian city, whereas yeah. I think that LA and Southern California in particular is often thought of as an Asian city, if you know what I mean.
I don't think so,
but I think that it's time. Like, I think that it's rare. It isn't like, I was telling Dan, I'm like, this is one of the first times I've really seen, you know, New York as, you know, from the angle of this is an Asian city.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of liked the vision, like the picture, that the image of it that he was able to put together in that short film.
Yeah, it's
'cause it seemed true. Like, that was how I experienced the city. You know.
Yeah, I think it's about, and one of the critiques that I have with the, like, the quote Asian American, you know, frame of analysis, it's that the analysis always seems to come from a place of not having a stake in the country. Like, it always is kind of pleading, like, oh, we're here, please see us. We're kind of new. We don't really have a home. We're just kind of like floating on the breeze here. And that's a couple of decades behind the material reality of the situation, I think.
I don't know where that comes from. I'm always curious where that actually comes from. Because I know what you're talking about.
Right? It's a very vague, like pleading mm-hmm. for a place, which presupposes that there hasn't already been a place that Asians have been basically occupying and kind of shaping to their tastes and their will, right? But there isn't an actual like stake in this country, that there isn't some stake to actual like land, a geography, a territory, basically. And it's hidden behind very like academic language, like, oh, we're just, you know, we're just in the fight against white supremacy, blah, blah, blah. Or we're an allyship for, you know, to right the wrongs of historical colonialism and blah, blah, blah. But past all that, it's kind of implying that these people are not just like culturally or politically homeless, like they're actually homeless. They need to put on a show of like almost weakness to be allowed to stay, basically.
Yeah, you know, I'm starting to feel like a lot of that actually came out of academia.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, but it was derivative. Like, it was part of, this is the big, okay, if you were to ask me one major, what was the big thing that I got out of this whole Plan A project? It is the realization that whatever thing that we think made us unique as a racial group in America as Asians, like there were these very peculiar things about being Asian that nobody understood. I realized that that's completely untrue, that everything we were experiencing is experienced by other groups, but in a different, maybe in a somewhat different presentation. Mm-hmm. The specifics of it are different, but the broad, the broad shape of things are the same. Mm-hmm. And one of the big things that I keep noticing over and over is that there's always an intra-racial class conflict.
Mm-hmm.
And that the class conflict is constantly being, I don't know how to say it. It's like constantly being confused for being a racial traitor, right? So to the extent that there's like a racial there's a class conflict within a racial group or an ethnic group, a particular community, that gets interpreted as a sort of racial issue or an ethnic issue, and often has to do with one of authenticity versus loyalty and, you know, all this stuff.
Oh yeah. Especially since class issues are the identity marker that's still taboo among leftist to liberal discourse.
What do you mean by that?
I watched a lot of DNC stump speeches.
Uh-huh.
Especially in the last, over the last, like the post Clinton years, basically. Mm-hmm. And then you can see the radical shift towards, you know, like basically like roughly DEI talking points, right?
Mm-hmm.
A wide umbrella to, you know, the rainbow flag is welcome here. Everybody's welcome here, but nobody mentions poverty. Like, poor is somehow not an identity marker that's explicitly, covered. And, you know, I remember you talking, and I think this was a brilliant bit of analysis you put out there, but talking about like being like race as like connecting like race and disease theory, basically. Like, we talk, a lot of people talk about race as kind of this like chronic condition that everyone's managing or overcoming.
Yeah, once that's you see it, it's kind of disturbing, I gotta say.
And that's how they talk about poverty. So they'll be like a Latino guy, you know, talking about the American dream, how he's successful. And every time like poverty or coming from difficult circumstances mentioned, it's only in the context of having overcome it.
Mm-hmm.
And then invariably, like, you talk, all of these people who are put up there as like bashed as like pillars of diversity and hallmarks of, you know, the inclusivity of the Democratic Party, blah blah blah, these motherfuckers are all rich.
Oh, I see what you're saying. It's taboo in the sense, like, you can never accept being poor. It's always a problem.
It's
you
a
can't
problem
just be, you can't just be like a, you know, a blue collar person with not a lot of money, and that's just how, that's
and
just
you're
what
not
your
gonna,
life is.
You're not going to be invited to go do a speech. Yeah. It's always like if you are. I mean, white, it's almost like guaranteed. But occasionally, they'll have like someone who's a nurse or something, right? If you're a minority, you'll be there to talk about the wonders of the American dream, how you are a shining example of how the American dream is alive and it works for people like you, and it works because, you know, because you vote people like Biden or whoever, you know, you vote blue, and that's why the American dream is flourishing.
You know, that kind of ties into that Turchin theory about overproduction of elites.
Yep.
And how, like, look, it's not good enough to just want to be like, look, I just want to, you know, I just want to earn my worker, you know, my work. I just want to be a worker. You know, mm-hmm. I don't want to be anything special. I just want to live life easy, you mm-hmm. know, low profile, you know, that's it. No, everyone's got to aspire to some higher calling, higher status, higher this. Everyone's got to do it. That's your, it's almost an obligation, right? Like, you can't aim I don't want to say low, but you can't aim even, right? Like, you can't just point your gun, your sight straight. You got to point up,
mm-hmm.
you know,
and material up, meaning like the dollar bill in your bank account. That's what we're talking about here.
Dollars and status. Yeah. You know, like overall status. I would say there's a variable. There's a variable there, which is also just sort of like the prestige of your industry.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a lot of people will take shitty money just to be in a prestigious industry like show business or,
I mean, you know. It's such a tricky thing. Like the owner of the LA Times, Patrick Soon-Shiong, he's a mm-hmm. billionaire, but he's also a medical doctor. I saw an interview.
He's a pharma guy, right?
Yeah. But I noticed in some talk he did or something, he wasn't introduced as the owner of the LA Times. He wasn't introduced as a pharma guy. He was introduced as a doctor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. That was his legitimacy. That's the credentials that they're bringing him on this panel allegedly for, because he's a doctor, so he can speak mm-hmm. on doctor shit, and he's got that legitimacy. They don't mention that he literally owns the Los Angeles freaking Times.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, so without that frame of analysis, I don't really find the whole race discourse to be very useful at all. I think it serves more as a distraction than anything.
Wait, what's the jump there? I missed the connection between him being a doctor and the racial.
Talking about the taboo of class.
Mm-hmm.
And the way we talk about race is basically, to me, it serves as more of a distraction than talking about like more class issues.
I see.
But the way that, you know, you're talking about like the elites among us being promoted and, you know, the things that they talk about, the things that they care about. And it's like as a, there's a limit to how much like in common I can be with someone who is a billionaire, but also happens to be, say, East Asian.
Mm-hmm.
Our interests do not align at all. I think we're antagonists a great deal of the time. That they're Asian, yeah. I don't know exactly to what extent that matters to me, or how it affects me, except to provide cover for
I think what it is is that to the extent that there's like a class divide that acts as a sort of line of scrimmage that, you know, like the line that separates the two teams in a football match, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like they're lining up on the line of scrimmage against each other. I feel like, you know, we are the Asian American population at large is sort of either facing off against Asian American elites or is on that line of scrimmage to some extent. Mm-hmm. Not 100%, but I do think that we have a particular sensitivity, and I would say, let me put it this way. No one quite peaks or creates our class resentments quite like seeing a fucking asshole Asian person with shitty politics. Like, we could see this. Nothing quite provokes what I would consider a form of class consciousness in the sense of, you know, fuck that snob, or, you know, what a pretentious fucking asshole, that kind of thing. For an Asian person, quite like seeing another Asian person doing that, being like that.
Yeah.
Do you see what I'm saying? Like, we can see the elitism of whites, of the white elite, of the black elite, or whatever. And as an Asian person, kind of like, not my problem. You know what I mean? But when you see another Asian person doing it, I mean, first of all, who are they flexing on? And who are they condescending to? You know, they don't really have the guts to like condescend to like other races, mm-hmm. right? So they do it in-house.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so I think the thing with class, you know, what I don't agree with, not agree, what I think is a trap, it's there's a circularity to this leftist bullshit discourse about how, I'm sorry, you know, I this is just what I see a lot in, you know, I would say traditional liberal discourse, you know, stuff like Jacobin or something like that, talking about how race is used as a wedge, or some race is used to obfuscate class, and racists are there in order to distract us into racial conflict when we should be really talking about class conflict. And then I think you get, I view it as a very tiring chant of it's class, not race, class, not race, class, not race, because it's both. It is both, but
they color each other. Like the classist racism and racist classism, like that permutation, it matters. You can't just say it doesn't
matter. White people, you know, because white people are driving that chant, and what they, because they're, look, white people need to understand, like, you're racist, but so everyone is racist to a degree. Like, white people, the thing that pisses me off about white liberals is they believe that they're just not racist, and they think that this is an issue about the judgment of their souls. And I'm like, it's not. I'm not saying that white people are racist to, like, yell at them or denigrate them, or just, like, just understand that it's not that you're, like, KKK racist. It's that you don't you don't see other races clearly. Like, you don't see us clearly because you keep trying to understand our racial identity rather than analogizing it. Because the problem is white people lack what I would say, like, a racial conscience. Maybe they're not racist. What they do is they lack racial consciousness, you know? And so many do, but I just don't think that they understand that their class issues, it's really, like, from our perspective, like, this is an internal fight by white people. Like, when I see white liberals losing their shit over Donald Trump, I'm like, that's your problem.
Yeah, this is white on white.
This is your problem. You guys have a problem, and it's in-house. This has to do with your racist uncle. This has to do with what town you grew up in. This has to do with you not wanting to be conflated with white trash. Right? My problem. And so when white people are going around, running around saying that Trump is, you know, the most dangerous thing, and he's awful, awful. I mean, me as an Asian, I'm like, I think this is really you guys having, like, a white crisis.
It really is.
And it's a class-based issue, but it's an intra-class issue, meaning I think Donald Trump is, he is raising, he is to white people, I think, what a lot of, you know, like, MR Asian types would be to, like, Asian American liberals, you know,
he's embarrassing. So that's partly my disgust at this whole political, I don't know, roadshow that they're putting on. It's almost a faked outrage, you know, Trump did this, Trump did that. No, you did right down to, no, you just don't, you just find him embarrassing.
Yeah. I think so too.
And this is supposed to be my problem. And, like, how fucking dare you take all that bullshit you've got going on because you've got beef with your embarrassing, you know, redneck family in Idaho or whatever, and then trying to put that on me. Like, this is somehow something that I'm supposed to internalize and reproduce on your behalf. This is not my problem.
Yeah.
My own perspective on this is not reflected in any wider political discourse. That's on y'all. You guys figure it out then. Leave me out of it.
See, that this is what I mean by that it's both. It is class. Class is a primary foundational social division in America. Absolutely. But it's categorized. There's multiple, I think, parallel class divisions, and they're operating within race, within racial categories. So the white class divide is analogous and it's similar to the black class divide, which is similar and analogous to, let's say, the you know, Latino class divide, you know, like that, which definitely exists, which mm-hmm. definitely exists. And that absolutely rhymes with what's going on with Asians. And so I think the big lesson for me has been that, you know, a lot of like what we want to dismiss as embarrassing squabbling and, you know, infighting and stuff, I'm not saying that it's not, but it is a phenomenon that I think is not just totally without information. If not merit, I'm not saying like there's a lot of merit to what's being said. Sometimes there is, sometimes there isn't. It doesn't matter. There clearly is a certain kind of, there seems to be two types of Asians is what I keep coming to. Like, we did a pod, I remember once, called like Us Versus Them. And the point of that was, I was trying to ask the question to, I think Chris and Jung and Adam were there at that time. We were doing this in person, but like, have you guys noticed that, you know, as time goes on, you can kind of instinctually feel when you kind of meet another Asian person, if they're cool or not? Very simple. It's an instinctual thing, like whether this person is going to be game or not, like whether I'm going to be able to get along with this person or not.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very binary switch. And I think it ultimately has to do with, you know, like the sort of class subjectivity of that person. You know, if I get the feeling like this person's snotty and uptight or whatever, I'm not going to like that person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm just not. And then sometimes you see someone, you meet someone, and you just get this feeling like, oh yeah, they're straightforward, they're honest, they're not stuck up, they don't have a rod up their ass. I'll like this person. I don't need to know much more information about them. I don't need to know what's in their bank account. I don't need to know what they do for a living. But I absolutely just get the sense when I feel like someone's like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or I'm not even saying like get along like or not, but like I know how to modulate myself in order to talk or you know, to get along with that person.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how to respond other than saying like, no, I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah,
it's just this like little sense that tells you, oh yep, how about we not talk about politics?
Yeah. And I think that is the thing, like leaning into those differences is actually, okay, this is my big theory about assimilation, right? That there is a right way to do assimilation. Okay, the wrong way is being class aspirational and thinking that the proper way to assimilate is to become like sort of a, you know, a fancy white person in a big city.
Mm-hmm.
With fancy white people tastes. I mean, that's one way to do it. I think that's the wrong way to do it. I think the right way to do it is to start recognizing that a lot of the fucking fighting that we like, the a lot of the internal shit that we experience as Asians, like, you know, regarding our the way we feel about other Asians, like that is very easily relatable. Very directly analogous to how other groups in America think and feel. You know what I mean? Like,
mm-hmm.
we're not exceptions to this at all. Like, we are following this pattern very closely. And so to understand the rest of America, you just have to sort of extrapolate from your own experience and just kind of realize, like, yeah, you're already assimilated sort of just by being here.
Yeah, it's not a four letter word.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think we're retreading some old, we're revisiting old ground.
I don't think we are point. Because.
No. I mean, we talked about assimilation quite a bit, you know, mm-hmm. it's not a four letter word. For one thing, if you're here, like you're gonna assimilate. If you're here, aren't you supposed to? You're supposed to be able to, you know, be comfortable here. You're supposed to be part of the culture. You're supposed to, you know, enjoy being here.
It's a
right?
very metaphysical question too, isn't it? I mean, like, what do you mean? I mean, yeah, of course you're going to assimilate. It's going to happen. You're here.
It's an inevitability.
If like, you're physically like, assimilated, you're going to assimilate. Like, you are assimilated.
Yeah.
The question is, how do you go about it? Like, you know.
Yeah, but like I feel like for part of this that like there was an extreme fringe of this discourse that's like, how do we prevent assimilation, right? How do we stop this? Like I remember some, you know, crazy times on Reddit where people who, you know, I don't know if they're telling the truth or not, but like they're talking about being parents and then like not holding back on teaching their kids English or showing like American shows to their kids, but you're raising them in America. And so, you know, assimilation being this horrible thing, like we don't want our children exposed to this. So what are you doing? You're raising, like, what do you think you're actually doing here? For one thing, you're not going to be able to control this. If you try to do it that way, it's gonna happen. It's a good thing to have it happen if you can control how it happens and on what terms, right? The entire question is, on whose terms are you assimilating? I totally understand being kind of forced or being bullied into it. Like, I think that's probably a big like meta current under, you know, those like stinky lunch stories, right? Kind of feeling like bullied into liking tuna salad sandwiches or Lunchables or whatever the fuck, right? That's kind of like forcible assimilation that's not on your terms. But like, is that really the story for most of us?
I mean, at a young age, you know, but like, whatever. I mean, I think the issues that I'm interested, I guess we can write children's books about that or whatever, but it has no, it doesn't matter to me, right? I'm a grown ass man, you know. I don't care about that.
Yeah, but like being maturity is, I think, being able to mature and being able to deal and maybe thrive in this society. I'm not saying that this is a great society. There's a lot of parts of it I actively reject and do not want, like, do not want my life or my you know, my personality reflect at all. But being able to like critique it dispassionately, but from a person, like just from knowing myself and what I value, and I'm able to pick and choose what I allow in and what I keep out. I feel like that's a good process, isn't it?
I think the goal for me when it comes to this notion of assimilation is making, just basically feeling at home. Meaning like I'm of this place, I was born here. And I'd be really hard pressed to point to another spot on Earth that is more my home than the East, you know, either New York City or, you know, the environs of Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. I'd be hard. I mean, my parents are from Taiwan. I'd be hard pressed to say that I feel at home at all in Taiwan. I don't. Mm-hmm. I'd be hard. They were born in Shanghai. I'd be hard pressed to say that I feel at home in Shanghai or in mainland China. I don't. Not compared to here. Right. So I think the issue, though, is like, you know, OK, well, then how at home exactly do you feel here? And I think the problem that might present itself is if you buy too much into Asian American standard theory, let's call it that, you know, we don't need to go over what that means. I think like built into that narrative is, and I think you would agree, I think you've been saying this, right, is like a certain essential alienation that's at the core, like to be Asian American is to be alienated from your surroundings. Like this isn't your home, you know, like, and yeah, that's presented as a problem, but it also is presented as axiomatic, meaning it's both a problem, but it's necessary. It's absolutely true, you know, and it's not, because that's a subjective experience. You know, whether I feel at home here or whatever has nothing to do with what other people think. Mm-hmm. Okay. Like I could go around thinking that other people don't belong and they don't give a shit. They don't care what I think.
I think so that's a big important part. You know? There's a part that's part of like the general, say, liberal theory of things that says that you cannot, your belongingness actually depends on everyone welcoming you in.
Right.
It's
It's completely stripping you of any sort of subjective sovereignty. Mm-hmm. You know, because
so there's no room to say I'm here. Fuck you. Like that's not going to change. So you know, this is not my problem.
Who am I saying fuck you to? I mean, let's face it. Ordinarily, when we go around, no one's even noticing you. No one cares. No one's thinking about whether you belong here or not. The only person thinking about it is the subject who's been imbibing this shit about, you know, the you know. No, I'm not saying that the idea of the perpetual foreigner isn't true. I'm just saying, like, that's an academic observation, but that should not color or in any way confine your subjective autonomy, your personal autonomy, you know? Yeah. And so
it's disempowering and kind of dehumanizing, because then you're constantly, you have to relate to yourself from the outside in for how other people see you. You construct yourself based on how other people are basically rating your existence and the legitimacy of it in your, what is essentially your own home.
Yeah.
Like, fuck that. So I've never felt more alienated than reading like academic or, you know, cultural commentary by Asian Americans, and then having it be forced upon me that this is actually my true state of being, this alienated, homeless, listless person who's forever rejected by wider society, never, quote, seen.
Yeah. See, and this is a thing that, frankly, pisses me off about the whole West Coast versus East Coast thing, which look, when I talk about West Coast versus East Coast, I'm much more interested in talking about the landscape. I'm much more interested in talking about accessibility to nature, to foreign countries, the weather, that kind of shit, right? I'm not interested in talking about the essential difference between Californian Asians and East Coast Asians or whatever, because I think that you'll find that this problem or this difference in subjective experience exists in both coasts. Mm-hmm. Meaning, I think that the alienated, like, for example, fucking all those Asian American elites that perpetuate this stuff are all in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. You know, like, fucking, what's his name? The Viet Thanh Nguyen, and who's the guy that I used to scream at on Twitter? Jeff Yang or whatever his name is. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, they're all out in the West Coast. Even though I think we have to take responsibility for Jeff Yang because he's like originally a New Yorker.
Yeah, he wasn't originally from here. I don't know about Viet Thanh Nguyen. But, you know, these people are
Viet Thanh Nguyen's from Orange County.
Okay, well, he has no excuse then. But, you know, I'll give him credit for knowing what fucking sells. This is what sells. And it's not really especially in the streaming age, it wasn't about selling to, like, the public. It's selling to studios who were basically pissing money on just content to stuff their feeds with. Mm-hmm. So in a very, very real sense, this is a... You know, it was marketed to us as this, like, this very democratic age where finally, like, minorities get media that represents them. No, it was very much just selling it to higher ups who were willing to just open a fire hose of money on whatever garbage, so long
as they're still doing it. They're still fucking doing it. And I'm not totally against it. I'm just saying that, you know, whatever it is, it's like, I don't know. I don't watch this stuff. I don't consume it, and I don't need to talk about it because I already know what they're going to be saying, and I just don't really care. I mean, some of it's not that bad, you know. Like, whatever that movie was, the one with Michelle Yeoh and Kehoe Kwan. Is that
Everything places? Everywhere? Well, yeah, I love that.
Like, whatever. Like, that's fine. I don't mind that movie. I don't really care. It wasn't bad. I just don't really care about it. Crazy Rich Asians, whatever.
There's just a limit to how much a person, how healthy it is to relate to media this very much.
Yes.
I at some level, you got to disconnect. It's not bad because it doesn't reflect your life. It's not good because your whatever weird thing you were anxious about has been revealed on screen. It doesn't make it good.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is that it's really not independent of, like, coast and geography at this point. I think, like you said, you know, when you were saying how it seems like culturally the distinction between East and West Coast is diminished, I think so too. I think if you come to New York City, it's probably going to feel a lot like socially in a way. It won't be that distinguishable from LA.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And I'm including the Asians.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like this whole idea of the uptight bow tie wearing white aspiring East Coast Asian versus the relaxed, you know, sweatshirt wearing UCLA attending. That it's so stupid. Like that, it's just not, has nothing to do with it, like reality
it's,
anymore.
It's only minor differences in just what they do, what these different personality types do. In New York, I'd expect to see a lot of those guys maybe in finance. Here, you're going to see in Silicon Valley. But
yeah, even then, I mean, here you have loads of tech, and in Silicon Valley, mm-hmm. you have loads of finance.
Yeah, you know, like so, I mean, these worlds have blended, and it's yeah. And like rating quote how Asian is a place is kind of stupid when there's plenty of white people eating xiaolongbao with chopsticks.
Yeah,
you know, like what is that? That's not a signifier that means
yeah. The only difference between California and New York that really matters to me is like, you know, how quickly can you get to Joshua Tree? How quickly can you get to Yosemite? How quickly can you get to Asia? How quick, you know what I mean? Like that mm-hmm. that stuff is interesting to me, you know, but all the other stuff, I'm like, whatever, we're all becoming monocultural, let's face it. Like, let's stop pretending yeah. that not any of this matters anymore. Okay, so yeah.
And you know, weird, I have never seen it analyzed this way. I'm just putting it out there in this little tiny corner of the internet, but I don't know what it's like in New York, but a trend that I'm starting to see is a big like chains from Asia making big moves into Southern California. I think it's either one of three. They either start in Vancouver, Los Angeles, or New York. But then wherever they start, they quickly spread.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it'd be like Korean fried chicken that takes off in Seoul, and they'll start to within a couple of years they'll try to make a US play. Mm-hmm. Same with like boba or, you know, bakeries or whatever. And these are like really sophisticated operations. Like service is excellent, decor, you know, they're on point. Small problem that I see there is it actually crowds out like Asian American businesses.
Mm-hmm.
Like that distinction, like there's it's so easy to get quote the real deal, like there's a new like tea chain, what's it called? Name doesn't really matter. Really big in Taiwan, like famous for inventing like the quote tiger sugar boba mm-hmm. thing, which is brilliant by the way, because I don't know how you convince people to pay $8 for sugar and milk, but mm-hmm. they did it. They yeah. really did it. They did the thing. And it's and you know, because it's a sophisticated operation, they're able to, you know, they know marketing, they know how to provide great service, and they have the money to buy a great location, all that. They make a lot of money. They do very well for themselves. And then I slowly start to see like the actual mom and pop boba shop that's been kind of running under a flickering fluorescent light for 20 years mm-hmm. put up a for lease sign.
Mm. Yeah,
I'm not saying it's a bad or good thing. It's just a thing that I'm noticing, and it deserves someone thinking about it, I think. Mm-hmm. Especially when we talk about like bring back quote the quote authenticity discourse, right? The mm-hmm. brand now that Asia is you know pretty well known for being a sophisticated, rich, culturally rich. Place, there's a big cachet now in saying like, oh wow, this fried chicken chain is directly from Seoul, or this is the number one tiger sugar boba chain in Taiwan, something like that.
Mm.
Or like, wow, yeah, this happening. Coffee chain was opened by like an executive from Luckin Coffee mm-hmm. or something.
Yeah, you think it's crowding out? I don't know if it's necessarily crowding it out, though. Maybe it is, but like here in New York, I feel like it's probably, I would, in my optimistic sense, I would say it's adding to the net of interest in, let's say, like Chinese cuisine or Korean cuisine. And it will make, hopefully, it will make people recognize like more homegrown stuff too. Like, there's a lot of homegrown stuff in Chinatown that has taken on sort of iconic status now.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you see a lot of tourists lining up outside, you know, a particular Chinatown, like, you know, barbecue place or a Chinatown, you know, like the what's it called? The Changfen, the, you know, like the dim sum places, you know, stuff like that. And those are homegrown places, and they're famous for being, you know, long time, they're like New Yorkers love nothing more than a restaurant that's been around for 50 plus years and has become
It's quote, infrastructure, iconic, basically. Right? Yeah.
You know, and so we love it. You know, the longer a restaurant has been around, the more authentic it is, and the more of a place it has in the sort of pantheon of New York authenticity. And then it finds a sort of like following again. And I think that's happening with a lot of like, you know, old Chinatown, even some Chinese restaurants outside of Chinatown are taking on, hopefully taking on a bit of that mystique. You know what I mean?
Maybe. I don't see that quite happening the same way. I think in I LA, know what you're mean? Talking about in LA. Mm. The hype cycle is so intense. Mm. It's really about the attention economy. You know, rents are going up, cost of everything is going up, right? And it's the people with the money and the know-how and the means to capture that Instagram audience, you know, the young audience. And I don't see a lot of reverence for history or tradition here. Mm. Like, we have an old school Chinatown, the original Chinatown that was built almost when LA was built, right? Around the turn of the 1900s.
Though, like, it's not really it that is,
see, that's what I mean. Like, it's abandoned once you go there. There's some like old school restaurants that still do well, but like you'll see more closed storefronts than not. And the ones that are historic are kind of just like hanging on, right? That's just like sheer nostalgia basically driving them. What happened when, you know, Chinatown outgrew itself? We just made another Chinatown. That's the San Gabriel Valley, right? And then that was the top destination for food, especially Chinese food. I think predominantly Chinese food. No one's going to Valley Boulevard to eat Korean food. Let's face it. And that was it for like 30 years. And then, you know, and then now you see like new hotspots opening up further east, like Roland Heights, et cetera. Orange County really took off. So it's really just like once the hype cycle, the generational hype cycle dies down, just keeps pushing outwards in a way that I don't think the East Coast can. There's still this like, just keep pushing. In this case, we built out the West. So just keep pushing east and build out something cool out there. So I see a lot of hype for stuff that's going down in Orange County, like further out, closer to like a little outside of what people would normally think of as LA, right? Like closer to San Bernardino County, places like that. Really like impressive spots, like dense, like culturally very, very dense, like high quality everything. But that means that there's like historic restaurants in like the OG Chinatown or like the San Gabriel Valley that are kind of languishing because the hype cycles keeps taking people further and further away.
Yeah. LA has that problem, I think, because it doesn't have like a fixed it unlike New York City, it doesn't have like a fixed structure or like shape, like it it's amorphous. Like
Manhattan's an island.
Yeah, like New York City has some very limited shape and it doesn't change, and that's just the way it is. And so here's my thing, like, man, it's sad because like I love New York, and just it's just the city is not in great shape, and there's a lot of negativity around New York City right now, but like it's spring and I don't know what it is. It's like, and that's the thing that LA may lack is a winter. And while that sounds great, and it is great, I'm sure, I've not experienced living in a place that has no seasons. And to me, LA has no seasons. I know you all think it does, but it doesn't.
No. Yeah, I thought it did. Yeah, no, we don't. We don't.
Not like we do. And yeah. I mean, we have, you know, we'll have like, you know, 80, we'll in 1 year, we'll have an 80 degree swing, you know, like we'll have lows of in the 20s, or I think it got even colder this year. And then we'll have a high of like 98, you know, in the summer. So when spring comes around in New York, the upside to having a really brutal winter, it wasn't a very brutal winter this year, but every New York City winter is brutal. You know what I mean? Comparatively. When spring comes around, I don't care who you are or what your personality is, it feels so like it feels so like revitalizing, rejuvenating. It mm-hmm. really does. I mean, there's something in the air when we start climbing out of winter right around now, mid-March, you know, and that first day, you know, like you could tell early March is when you start seeing the occasional outside diner, and all the outside diners are white, you know, like the courageous white people who don't are not scared of cold. And then by mid-March, and it's St. Patrick's Day weekend, and then, you know, it just starts, you know, the restaurants start filling up. And then when we went out last night, you know, we were in Greenwich Village, it was just hot. It was just popping with people. And we went over to Chelsea. It was just, every bar was packed and everyone was just in a great mood. And then today I took my wife down to where my new job is, like all the way in Tribeca. Mm-hmm. And I was telling her, look, I've never really been to Tribeca. I mean, I've driven through it, but there's actually specific parts of Tribeca I've literally never been to. Like, I've never been to Tribeca Park. People don't know that there's such a thing called Tribeca Park, but there is a little cute little park called Tribeca. I've never been there. And then my office is right near, I remember I was walking home and then I walked by the fire station. They had the Ghostbusters sign back out and they had the Ecto-mobile parked mm-hmm. in front because they're promoting the new Ghostbusters movie. And so they brought out the old sign, you know, from that firehouse.
They turned it back
into the Ghostbusters, station for the time being.
Mm-hmm.
And that area is just so, I was like, wow, like this place is so beautiful. I didn't realize like how beautiful Tribeca is. You know, I just think of it as the place that's near the Holland Tunnel.
I know nothing about that area. Is it like a mm-hmm. rich area?
Super wealthy. It's like, it's like like Robert De Niro lives there. You know, it's like super rich. Okay. And, it's quiet and tourists tend not to make it down there. I don't know why. I think it's a little bit cut off because of this Holland Tunnel complex. Like it's a little tricky to get to. Mm-hmm. And to the point where I myself like never found myself going over there. And so it's weird. It's kind of hidden in Manhattan for some weird reason. But then I started a job there. My job is there now. And I'm like, holy shit, this place is beautiful. All of this just to say like, like New York City is fucking gorgeous. And LA is gorgeous. And very lucky to have these two as our two sort of like heavyweight cities in the United States.
Yeah.
Like both are just wonderful cities. Like I'm so happy to be in, whenever I'm in LA, I'm so happy to be there. It's such an amazing place. I know it has its problems. New York has its problems, but like fundamentally speaking, it's got so much character and it's just fucking awesome.
I'm proud of us. These are our bastions. Dragging it back to downer shit. Like another thing that I reject about quote Asian American, you know, social discourse, right? Mm-hmm. Is this idea that we're trapped in some cultural backwater? Like we're the ones who are not up to speed. We're the ones who are kind of always two steps behind.
Yeah.
I completely reject that.
Yeah, it's just.
It's like, again another thing.
Are.
Like
maybe you fuckers are, not me. Leave me alone.
Yeah, like what is this we you're talking about here? For one thing, I'm not trying to get into some like hinterlands versus the urban metropolis cultural debate or whatever. That's not the point here. But the perception has always been, you know, New York just has this aura of cool, right? Has always been. So same with LA. Same with all these places that Asians. The bulk of Asians actually are.
We're an integral part of the city. Absolutely. This is something maybe a lot of people who don't have, you know, because I know LA people love their city so much, they don't really like leaving. And the same is true of New Yorkers, too. There is a certain insularity of the people here. It's like a metropolitan insularity, if you know what I mean. You remember that Sex mm-hmm. in the City episode of those guys that, like, never leave Manhattan? You know,
I don't know that I never watched that show.
Okay,
but I'll believe you.
I did watch some of it, and there was mm-hmm. a pretty funny one about this culture of Manhattan men who really don't know anything outside of Manhattan. Like they're just mm-hmm. you know, it's this metropolitan insularity. But You know,
that's like, not, and we've critiqued it before. Like we talked about, you know, you brought up, you know, those Manhattanites that are basically acting like it's just a satellite of Europe.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
So
yeah.
They won't venture out because, you know, like, oh, fucking Americans. We're not like those people. We're different. We're Manhattanites, or something. You know, that kind of that's sociopathic. That's not what we're talking about here.
Yeah,
I'm just rejecting the particular strain of Asian American normie discourse that just assumes that we're the ones always trapped on the cultural backwater here. We're not up to speed. We have to be brought into the fold. The bulk of Asians are coming up in places like New York, Southern California, Northern California, you know, these very, very vibrant, very majorly important metropolitan hubs. So the implication that somehow we live here, you understand that we do, but you're still imputing this kind of backwardness onto us. Like, fuck you. Where do you get off saying we so often here that you feel like some kind of rube at a country club is not my problem. Yeah,
because
here.
That industry attracts people that just have this petty insecurity. And they want, you know, here's the thing. I was talking to some of my Twitter moots who I love. There's a shout out to some of the youth. So I think they know who I am, or they know who they are. Wonderful discussions with them about this stuff.
Okay,
They know who I am. I know who you are. But we were talking about someone had posted screenshots of like that Elliot Rodger guy, the guy who like murdered a bunch of like women and also his Asian male roommates at UC Santa Barbara.
Yep,
and he's a half Asian guy, and he had this huge. He had this whole story about how he fucking hated Asian men because Asian men were disgusting and, you know, sexually, you know, small dick losers and all this stuff. And then he said there was nothing more disgusting than when he went to a party on the campus and there was this white girl who was just hanging out with this Asian guy at the whole time. Mm-hmm. And she wouldn't pay attention to him, to Rogers. And, you know, I read that and I finally started to really understand what was going on. I was like, this guy's, he's a loser, right? Like he's a weirdo, you know, he's just fucking weird and he probably creeps people out and it has nothing to do with his race. I mean, maybe you could trace there being racial dynamics involved but fundamentally speaking, right? His problem is that he's a fucking weirdo. He's a loser.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And like girls get that sensation from him. So what does he do? He pins it on his race.
Right.
I'm not the loser. It's because it's because of the inferiority of the Asian gene. And I think that's a crutch. I really do. I think that people, in a way, like when we talk about, now he's an extreme example, but I think if people start saying stuff like, oh, you know, they desexualize Asian men. And I'm not saying that's not true. Okay. But we're talking about it at a very broad level. Right. But I do think that this kind of discourse allows people who are racializing their personal problems. Mm-hmm. And they're looking to.
Yeah, and it may not be true 100% of the time, but it sure provides a whole lot of cover for those who do. So it just becomes really hard to separate signal from noise on that.
Yeah, and they're turning what should be like a personal struggle into like a racial struggle, you know, and it's inappropriate to do that. I think that kind of thing is, and look, I'm not denying that there is, you know, cultural bias against, you know, Asians and in a certain specific direction. But as you see, if you look at emasculation in Hollywood or you look at hypersexualization in Hollywood, stop trying to own that shit as like an Asian property. It happens to everyone. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then, you know, you've got this complex that keeps talking about this over and over as if it's, yes, it's true, but is it that important? Well, it is important, I think, for a lot of people who need to find a way to depersonalize what are probably pretty personal problems. I mean, I think Elliot Rodgers had a lot of personal issues that he, and then in his bizarre way of racializing and projecting that onto race, became what he was, a fucking a mass murderer. You know, because I think that there was a lot of fucked up thoughts going on in there.
Yeah.
That conflated personal problems with racial problems. It was just really weird. The whole thing was just really weird. And I have to say that there, I saw, I've recognized elements of the Asian American academic complex in the stuff he was saying. If I'm being
yeah, if I could extrapolate that one step further, the therapy complex as well, the psycho, the psychology, psychotherapy complex is big on that shit too.
Yeah, for sure.
So you know, and it's like, well, then you know, then what are you supposed to do? I don't know. My only solution, I don't have a, I don't have an ideological, you know, thing to throw at it. It's just time. I just had to sit there and think it through for myself and only for myself and figure it out. I don't know if there actually is a one size fits all solution other than this is, this might be the, this might be just what maturity means. You just have to sit there and think it through.
Yeah. Yeah. You know what the hardest, you know what the hardest step for me now is? And, you know, this is, I'm saying this as a good, this is maybe a humble brag, actually, you know, like this is, this might genuinely be a humble brag, but like the hardest part of this whole identity thing, right, for me now is to rid myself of self-loathing on account of being an American.
Oh, yeah.
I find this hard. Like, I'm not joking. Like, I don't have any Asian self-loathing. Like, that's not my issue, right? If I have any problems with my Asian identity, it's that I'm not really like that literate in Chinese culture. So, you know, my problem is I'm not Chinese enough.
Right.
For me. But I'm very American. And my problem is I have a lot of self-loathing as an American because there's just a lot of shit that is upsetting me these days and kind of embarrassing me. And it's hard to be a proud American in the way that I want to be. You know, like I can't do this stupid beer drinking redneck bullshit on the one hand, but I can't do this liberal fucking, you know, this liberal
high-handed liberal platitude spouting, you know, hypocrite basically.
Yeah. And they're totally far, like, trust me, like, you know, white elites in Manhattan are nowhere near as culturally sophisticated as they pretend to be. Mm-hmm. It's embarrassing, frankly, when they try to be. you know, so I don't take like, so what do I take pride in? You know, like, it's a very personal thing for me, you know, the pride of being an American, but I don't have a crew of people that really I can share this with. This is a highly personal thing. My view of why I do enjoy being an American is purely personal. I don't, there's not like a main vein of like American subjective consciousness at a group level that I can tap into and feel like, yeah, these are my people. You know what I mean? And so now while I don't feel necessarily alienated from Americans, I can't help but feel like a certain level of distance from, and maybe a little bit of personal superiority.
I think that's healthy. I don't know if there really necessarily is a, I don't know if there even is such a thing as an American consciousness the way that there could be in older societies.
I guess, so, but then you know what? You know, when you walk around in your city and you're just, you realize how much you love it.
That's local. That's personal.
Isn't that where it starts?
I think so. I think so.
How do you love an entire fucking continent? You know, like you got to start with where you are, right?
It's too fucking big.
Okay, but I'm just saying, when I'm walking around New York, I love it. I love, you know, and I'm sure that there are so many American cities that I would love if I went to, and but I just don't, you know, I don't really travel as much internally as I do. Oh, I was in Arizona. I loved it. I was like, my God, this is like the most beautiful fucking place I've ever been. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I loved it. And I love the culture there. Like, I love the weird local culture that is way more tied into its own history than people would say it is, but like they're very aware of their local, of their localized identity as well as their historical identity, I would say. Mm-hmm. Much more so than we would give them credit for.
Yeah.
Where am I going with this? I'm just trying to find a way mm-hmm. to be a proud American. You know, I really do. Mm-hmm. I think that's what I actually want, and I'm searching for it. I think this country has beautiful bones, but I just feel like there's just, and I feel like I like the people. I am the people, but there's just so many fucking idiots in charge. There's just so much corruption, and there's just so many problems. You know?
Yeah, but I mean, that just sounds like every place on Earth once you zoom in close enough, I guess.
No. I don't. Okay, fine. But what do I care? What do I care if it's just like everywhere else? Does that make it better? I don't think so.
No, like, again, like I don't know. We're just two fish asking, is there a chance that we might be wet? You know? Like, if you love it, you love it. That's all that matters. Do we need to dig that much deeper into it? My only frustration is I felt like a lot of the academic types kind of racialized problems with being American. I mean, not racial, like what I mean by that is imputing, feeling very valid frustrations with the concept of being an American, but then attributing that to like racial friction.
Yeah, I don't know.
This whole like that whole like, oh, I'm trapped between two worlds, like that's just a fiction that we just really have to drop. It's getting embarrassing. No, we're not. No, you're not. You're actually very, very fully American. For one thing, no one other than Americans say that. So how can you say that and not? How can you say that you just came up with that shit on your own? That's a uniquely us thing, and that's just a thing we're gonna have to ditch. It's, you know, talking about like, oh, the alienation of, you know, like not being connected to your elders or not being connected to a culture or just, you know, being forced into consumerism, blah, blah, blah. Like, it sounds like you're doing a general social critique and then just sort of throwing in some yellow flavor into that.
You mean when I say that
I do say that
because I do think it's a big problem.
Oh no, I'm saying we've talked it through before. I'm just kind of it's just like a rehash of stuff we've talked about in previous years, just re-raising gripes I have with the commentary about us and resenting that might be the record left of our time here.
Yeah.
And I would very much like for that to not be the case, but there's a limit to what I can do here.
Yeah. I just feel like, you know, if you really do love, like the reality of America, you know, like I'm not like a jingoist at all. Like I fucking hate, our militarism. It's such a fucking downer, man. You know, I just hate a lot of our political culture. But by and large, people are pretty cool. You know, I'm just saying that like there's a lot to love, but it's really sad because it's just like there's so many people trying to ruin it. and so it's kind of like, it's almost like, do you just give up? You know, like do you just say, you know what, fuck this. It's just not worth trying. You know what I mean? Like, should I just...
Well, trying in what sense, right?
Trying to commit yourself fully to like being an American and doing what you can to... doing whatever you can to try and make the best of this place, not just for yourself, but like, you know, trying to be like really civically minded and active and, you know, and bought in and, you know, on board. And it's
a really stark binary, right? You either do that, or you retreat into this kind of nihilistic insular bubble of your own making. And I do think a lot of SoCal Asians are guilty of that. Kind of like a build a wall mentality, right? Mm-hmm. That's everything outside this wall is someone else's problem. I'm only responsible for what's inside, right? It can get myopic very easily.
Yeah, actually, that's always been my problem with SoCal Asians is they're highly ignorant of the outside world. They do have that Los Angeles insularity.
I mean, bundle Orange County into that. It's becoming a, it's like Asian American politic identity in SoCal is more like akin to nation state building than anything else. I think I'm not kidding about that. It just, it feels like more like the process of a nation building, the politics of a small nation state within a bigger territory. So it can get insular. It can get insular nihilistic.
And kind of embarrassing.
It is.
Yeah.
But then the only, like if you decide no, like none of that's for you, then your really only option is maybe you would be happier elsewhere, like outside the country.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
So, I mean, those are pretty like stark options, I guess.
I'm just saying, like, I dig deep, you know, Jess. I took for granted my relationship with like being American.
Mm-hmm.
And now that I'm like truly questioning that, like, or I'm not even truly questioning. I feel like the whole thing is in up for, like, the whole thing is being questioned like every day by everyone. You know, it's,
I think,
not just
so.
Me.
I mean, why would a campaign thing be like, oh, we're fighting for the soul of America? Why is this? Why? Yeah, why?
We clearly
do they
know
that,
it's,
right?
You know, something's going on. And I got to tell you, I just get hit with these feelings of nostalgia that I never experienced before. It's not necessarily that I want to go back, you know, it's not that, but just like the innocence and beauty of American culture in the 80s as experienced through looking back at its relics, you know, like I was just looking at these local Washington DC area advertisements for like Junri Taekwondo, you know, and then someone was telling me about how Junri was actually the master, like he introduced Taekwondo to the United States. I was like, oh, really? The local guy down in Virginia was that guy? You know, he's like, he's the Bruce Lee of Taekwondo. I had no idea.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I had no idea. And I grew up with him. And I just thinking about America then, and I just get these waves of like nostalgia of like, wow, how beautiful was it? I don't know if that's just, that's nostalgia working. You know what I mean? But like,
we should do a nostalgia episode. I've been feeling it pretty hard.
You have, like, it's not just me, right?
No, we're all like combing through the past and like, where did we go wrong? Where did the timeline fork? When did it all start going wrong? I've been reading Hunter S. Thompson and it's just like, he's a brilliant writer. I love him to bits, but, like he's like, it's wild. He has this really extravagant, like extremely well-written series of essays, basically like it's a eulogy for America, basically talking about this is the end of the American dream. And he wrote this in like 1976. He was like, Nixon is the fall of America.
Right. So, okay. Let's talk about this on the next pod.
Okay.
Because if he was writing that in the 1970s, that suggests to me that there is a cognitive problem here. Nostalgia is a trap, I think, in a way. This is my worry, is that...
I'll send it to you. You should read his
Send it to
writings.
Me. I'll read it. But if he's writing that in the 70s, and then now we're in the 2020s feeling this deep nostalgia, we would say that about the 70s. Then isn't the issue here that people are idealizing America's past, but then maybe perhaps overly or failing to see the beauty of the present? Like people, it's easy to see now the beauty of the 70s from the 2020s, probably a lot harder to see it from the 70s itself. Right.
I think it depends on from what angle you're looking at. Like my personal entry point to this recent exploration of nostalgia was I started buying like old computers. Old gadgets on eBay from the 80s and 70s. One of them actually like almost brought me to tears.
What was it?
It's the TRS-80.
The Radio Shack. Oh my goodness. Mm-hmm.
From 1983. Yeah. It was in pristine condition. It was like $100. It was nothing. One little detail just fucked me right the hell up. Mm. It's not even the device. It's the manual that came with it. It was so beautifully laid. It wasn't even like just a throwaway thing with a glue binding. They had spiral bound that.
Oh yeah. Yeah. The Apple II stuff was all like that too. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was all spiral bound.
Spiral bound. Done. Like, yeah. like everything was exquisitely explained, laid out. I mean, and like stereo equipment from that era too. Mm-hmm. Like, I think I don't know if we talked about it on a pod or not, or just between the two of us, but talking about like, there was an actual moment when there was a high watermark, the best it's ever been between like producer and consumer in America. Like those were quality. It was quality products, meant for an educated, discerning audience that's receptive to that kind of thing. So I know
you think
that
that's gone fully. I mean, you don't think that we were actually living in an era that, you know, that is built on that and is still creating beautiful.
I think it's been completely corralled, and I think the consumer has been degraded. And
you don't think kids hacking Raspberry Pis is something that's wonderful? You know. My nephews do that.
I do think it's wonderful. Mm-hmm. I do think that we should have been much further along. That should have been an ethos that should have been a continual ethos, not just a revival of a hacker mindset over the past 10, 15 years. Mm. Like consumer devices, like the TRS-80, it's very much a computer, right? It doesn't come like you get out of it what you put into it. You are not fed a thing. It is a thing that enables other things, not mostly a very small TV you put in your pocket.
I love, you know what? We should have fucking potted about this from the beginning because it's like one of my favorite topics, which is like, you know, if you're looking at this artifact from the late 70s or early 80s, this, you know, this TRS-80 computer, beautiful thing. And in fact, I think that they created a lookalike computer for that show Andor. They actually have an Imperial like sort of desktop computer that looks just like the TRS-80. I'll send you a screenshot of it sometime. You know, the one where the monitor is to the left and it has two disk drives on the right.
I didn't watch Andor, but I believe you.
No, but you know, the TRS-80, there's a factor where there's like a 9-inch CRT on the left and then two floppies.
Oh yeah.
It looks just like that. So point being, this artifact, it's not just the artifact itself, but also the sort of like alternative future that it was pointing to.
Mm-hmm.
And
it was very much reflective of it's never the product itself. And I think that's maybe a thing that consumer society loses, right? The perspective on that. You're not just being sold a thing and that's it. It's supposed to be a relationship between you and that thing. I think a big driver of nostalgia for people right now is that there is a very limit to the interactivity you can have with most commercially available devices.
Mm. I feel like though, you know, in the 70s, we would have been able to draw that distinction between the 70s and the 50s or whatever. And I'm just saying there must have been loads of bullshit in the 70s as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe there was less bullshit than there is now. I'm not saying there's no directionality to this whatsoever. In fact, I think I'm debating against myself here. I'm taking an opposite position right now than I usually am just because I'm trying to kind of widen my view of things. But like, okay, so here we are in the 2020s. Waxing nostalgic about the 70s or 80s and thinking about the alternative 2020s that could have been if we had continued along certain vectors that were present in the 70s. Mm-hmm. Instead of taking these distorted, you know, and corrupted routes that we took to get to this somewhat dystopian and, you know, suboptimal future that would have disappointed everyone from the 70s, including ourselves now that we're looking at it from that vantage point. But that presupposes this relationship where the 70s was the beginning and the 2020s were the result. But the 2020s are also a beginning of something and the 2040s or 50s will be a result. Do we actually give a shit about the 2040s or 50s? Meaning, you know, like in the 1970s, did we care about the 2020s or was that not really on everyone's mind? I don't think it was on people's minds. You know what I mean?
Like when I talk about spiral bound and like that's the detail that kind of screwed me up, right? They were clearly designing this for longevity, right? Like this manual was supposed to last a super long time.
Mm-hmm.
These were designed to be modular. So you buy the base and then you upgrade with, you know, with like a floppy drive or extendable memory or something, whatever. Right. And this manual that tells you how to do all of this, it doesn't come with a whole lot of like source code, but it lays out things that you can do with it. Right. it's supposed to, there was a vision for it being durable into the, there was a future for this product as a future for the consumer with this product as well. So I don't, probably not as far as into the future as the 2020s, but just the fact that it was designed to stay useful and be usable. Like for one, like it's a 40-year-old computer. I'm not going to be able to open. I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to turn on my iPhone 40 years from now that I bought last year. There's no way. Are those technological decisions or was that a business decision?
You don't think so? You might be able to. There's no reason why you shouldn't be able to. I mean,
I'm talking about, like, I have a Mac from, I have several actually, from like the, 2005, 2008. I can't do shit on those. Like, you turn it on and Apple will say like, oh, your operating system is too out of date to support.
Oh,
you can't do anything.
Yeah.
I mean, and the crazy thing is the Mac Pro that I have, like the stainless steel case could probably survive a nuclear like bomb. Mm. It is thick steel. You could kill a man with that thing, right? Mm-hmm. But it's basically furniture now. Nothing inside is usable.
Well, let's not pretend the TRS-80 is usable at this point. You know what I
mean?
It'll turn on, but you can't do anything with it, you know?
I mean, yeah, I know. But
is it supported? No, but the operating system doesn't even get updated. It just is what it is, you know?
Well, I mean, but I think the 70s, just for computers, it was a kind of high watermark because it was kind of a democratization of like in the, you're talking about the 50s, that's the dawn of computing basically, mm-hmm. where you were doing timeshares on, you know, one of five terminals in the country that were all affiliated with, you know, universities, elite universities.
What do you think we should do? Should we continue this for another 30 minutes or should we put this 90 minutes
as a
full episode and then we'll continue.
We'll continue because this is like a different. This is an entirely different.
Yeah, because I don't want to go too far into this because I think it's super interesting. I want to get my thoughts around this, but because I absolutely share, I think like a lot of people, not just you and me. Like if you go on YouTube, there's whole fucking channels and subcultures devoted to tech nostalgia.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a couple mutuals on Twitter where we're always talking about we're following channels like Obsolete Sony and talking about the tech that we used to grow up with, and Iowa, stereo systems in the dorm rooms and Walkmen from when we were kids and stuff like that, video game consoles and diving deeper into the meaning behind that nostalgia, I think is really interesting because I think there's a huge amount of like just what we were talking about, you know, like those tech artifacts as signifiers of the kind of society we were living in, just like your spiral bound documentation set for the TRS-80, which I totally understand because like you're right, like the Apple IIe documentation, similarly beautiful cardstock on spiral bound, you know, whatever, it was made to last. Those pages were laminated. I mean, they're glossy, they're not, you know, they're not laminated, but they're glossy, really high quality print. And Americans spent $4,000 real $1983 on that stuff. I asked my parents.
Yeah.
My dad was like, I paid $4,000 in 1983 for that. Mm-hmm. Imagine that. And I was like, God,
and there's hard limits on what it can do. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, it turns on and it's fully mine in a way that the MacBook that I paid $3,000 for just isn't.
True. But true. I'm not that. We'll talk about this. Let me think about that because I think that that's a little bit complicated because it just fundamentally wasn't a networked machine, you know. And so
I have strong opinions on that.
I don't think we went a wrong direction
on networking too. So that might be a more technical conversation. This is just this. It's just like dusting off a bike or something to talk about Asian shit on Asian American discourse again. A couple of books that sets the tone for this pod that we absolutely should do, right? It's one was like Hunter S. Thompson talking about the fall of America in the 70s, right? We mentioned that. There's another one. It's called The Friendly Orange Glow. It's about the development of the Plato system from the University of Illinois. Yeah, Illinois. And then Hackers, right? So it was kind of funny to see the two. It's both written for the same time period, like the mid to late 70s. But you see one person is trend, their optimism's trending down, whereas everyone else's was up. But foretelling that there could be a wrong turn further down. So when you're talking about like, are we just like rose tinted glasses, like just looking at the 70s with rose tinted glasses? Well, if you actually look, it just depends on where you're looking, right? For things like computers, it absolutely was like a high watermark in the late 70s and into the 80s. I will die on that hill. Socially, I wasn't there, you know. Maybe Nixon was the harbinger of doom for the American dream. We can talk about that ad nauseum. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're talking about tech nostalgia though. Like, there are some hills that I will defend.
Okay. Yeah, let's do it. Yeah. So I'll be next time. Yeah, I love it. I love these rambling pods where we don't have like one fixed, you know, thing. We're just catching up, and it's always fun. Jess,
yeah, I'm just always curious who sticks around to the end of these things.
Weirdos and freaks like us. I love them all.
I hope you turned it on while doing chores, because I don't think it was a really like content heavy thing. I hope your dishes are clean.
Here's another thing we can talk about. Someone tweeted, I have no internal monologue. And everyone was like, what the fuck does that mean? I was like, yeah, what does that mean? What's an internal monologue? I want to get into this at some point, because I have no idea what internal monologue is. I don't know what that means. Internal monologue?
I heard that.
Yeah, I know what that... I know, but like, what does it mean to not have one or have one? Like, what is internal monologue? I mean, I always thought internal monologue is I sit down and I have a monologue in my head. But apparently people are saying, no, I'm constantly having a monologue. What are you talking about? I'm like, what are you talking about?
That's me.
What does that mean? Don't answer that now, because there's a whole thing I need to understand. What the hell an internal monologue is. I don't get it.
Oh, okay.
Not that I can't think in words. It's not that. But apparently some people are having this monologue all the time. And this is very interesting to me. So we should talk about that. I was like, what the fuck is it? You know, what does that mean? I have no internal monologue. I was like, that wasn't as mysterious as some of the responses that were like, yeah, I don't understand how one couldn't have an internal monologue.
Yeah, that's me. Like, I remember coming across that a couple of years ago, and then being like, how can you not have one?
Okay, we got to. This is great, because you got to explain this to me.
Okay, I have no idea if this is the same as everyone else's. It's just, it feels like there's a couple of Jesses in my head.
Yeah, yeah.
And we just trade the mic back and forth.
We got to talk about this, because I do not have that experience. All right. Okay.
I am just dying to know now. That is weird. Okay, we got it.
Stay tuned. We're going to talk about internal monologues and Radio Shack computers.
Come one, come all. Yeah. This is the party you're getting.
All right. Jess, okay. It was really good catching up again. Though, we've catched up. I'm just saying, it's good to have you on the pod again.
Yeah, good to be back. I'm sorry I was out for so long, but you know, slowly kind of getting back into the swing of things. This is definitely a big part of my life. It's always fun to do this.
All right. See y'all.
Okay. All right. Bye.